Well, this is the first of two Robbins lectures by William Baumol. A long time ago, 48 years to be exact, Lionel Robin was confronted with applications to join the graduate school at LSE. The applications included one from an American ex-serviceman, with references from people one had never heard of, coming from having graduated from a college which in the eyes of LSE at least was obscure. And to his credit, Lionel Robbins said, yes, we will have that student. And William Baumol arrived at LSE to start work on his PhD, which subsequently became his first book. He rapidly became firm friends with those of us who were students at the time and then young lecturers, with the school and with the Robbins family, who are happily are with us here now. A lot of you, of course, don't remember Lionel Robbins. He was our friend and mentor. If we'd spoken French, I think we would probably have called him Le Patron, affectionately. Mm-hmm. He was a very impressive man. He used to deliver his speeches and his conversation with in orotund Johnsonian phrases, but with a twinkle in his eye, for he was not pompous. On the contrary, he was warm and supportive to all of us younger people. He had come from spending the war in the economic section of the War Cabinet, which meant that it was we rather than he who was up to date with the latest in economic theory. But he was very tolerant of us. And we learnt from him and sought to imitate him in his remarkable ability to encapsulate the heart of any real economic problem in a few simple sentences. Well, William stayed here for a few years, and then to our personal regret, but delight on for his sake, was headhunted by Frederick Lutz to go to Princeton. And he and Hilda departed for Princeton, from where they have continuously remained in touch with the school. All these years later, William is now an emeritus professor from that distinguished institution and a professor at New York University. During those many years, he has emitted a more or less continuous stream of textbooks, articles, and monographs. Perhaps some of you know the textbooks, distinguished for their lucidity. I remember him introducing us to difference equations. Before William arrived, the only person who understood difference equations was Paul Samuelson. And for instance, in that admirable textbook, Operational Research and Economics, he taught at least me how to do Kuhn-Tucker analysis, for which I shall eternally be grateful. Well, I won't endeavor to survey all the fields of economics to which he has contributed. It is much shorter if I describe those to which he has not contributed. And preeminent among those is the theory of international trade. Hitherto, he has signally failed to add anything to the literature, a lacuna which he is now going to remedy. Over to you, William.
Thank you. It is, of course, customary to say what a delight it is to be wherever one happens to be. But, of course, in this case, it is nothing like that. Even the very location, the old theater, where I sat up there and listened to many lectures are memories, happy, pleasant. I remember Roy Harrod standing on the stage here delivering the lectures which became toward an economic dynamics. I remember when the electricity failed at the end of World War II, Nicky Caldor lecturing romantically by candlelight as though angelic. And above all, I remember the series of Lionel Robbins' magnificent lectures on history of economic ideas, because Lionel's lectures were so extraordinary in the depth of their contents and in the magnificence of their use of language. It was really an extraordinary experience, which of course grew, as I am happy to say, we grew to be very close friends, as we remain today, with more than affection, with love, with the members of his family. But so much for the niceties. Let me immediately attack my chairman for inaccuracy by pointing out, as Anne Bohm noted by not shaking her head at the misreporting of facts, that when I applied for admission to the London School of Economics, I was not admitted. I was rejected. And had the temerity immediately to write and say, when can I apply again? And then Lionel came up and said to Anne Bohm, I suppose we must let the poor man in. But I was not admitted for the PhD, only for the master's, and that, of course, conditional on performance. I may say, and this is fact, not lack of modesty, that having made what I will claim was a mistake, they tried to rectify it by making a mistake in the other direction, so that some 6 weeks later I was appointed to the staff. But the point is that this occasion, the sentiment that is attached to it, have led me to undertake things which I have never done before in several respects. First, I am presenting a paper of which I am clearly the junior co-author. The really guilty party sits before us, and you will have an opportunity to see the extent of his sin in due course. But I really felt, you know, I must say, several times I have chosen the LSE as the place to present new, what I thought were important new ideas. The first time sales maximization was first described on this stage, I gave my first lecture on contestability theory here, and I thought this called for something really, what that I believed was really important, and if another author had written it, well, that was the luck of the draw. The other point is that the folly of this presentation is that it calls for an extreme exercise of patience on the part of the audience. Ralph has been kind enough to claim that I write lucidly. My own interpretation when asked is that I always try to write so clearly that I even understand it myself. And today, we are going to be dealing, today and tomorrow, with subjects that, as you will see, really are common sense, but one gets at the common sense by way of some initial abstraction. And that is going to take, as I say, patience and understanding on your parts. There are so many friends here that at least I have hope on that score. But first, having spoken of my deep affection for Lionel Robbins and incidentally for Iris Robbins, whom I do deeply adore and whom we will be seeing the day after tomorrow, I would like to speak of a third person, and that is my co-author, because he is not like myself a dismal scientist, and though widely known, he is likely not to be known in this group. I should explain that he puts us in double jeopardy because he is both a distinguished mathematician and a successful business person. Thus, acquainted with both abstraction and practicality. He is known for his work on differential equations, and more serious for the group of us, he is the father of integer programming. In fact, it is about integer programming. It was integer programming that first brought us together some 35 years ago when the chairman of the mathematics department came over to me and said, there is a young man you have to meet. He has cracked the integer programming problem, and we met, and promptly I tried to explain it so clearly that I could understand it myself, and an article emerged. Obviously, Ralph survived the shock sufficiently to try a second time, and here we are again. As I said, he was also incidentally, is now president of the Alfred Sloan Foundation, but he was senior vice president and director of research at the IBM, and obviously knew when to get out. But in any event, you see, if you find the lecture today too practically oriented, you can blame it on Ralph for his business experience. If you find it too abstract, you can blame it on him because it is too mathematical. Now, we've saved our pretty pictures as a come-on for you to survive a second session. So there will be no pictures, no nudity, no R-rated exhibitions today. Those come tomorrow. The subject that I am dealing with on the basis of the papers which we have written. Oh, one final preliminary word. We have four articles that have been written by our enterprise, and I think they will be reproduced and available for those who can tolerate that sort of thing. We have been driven to deal both by Ralph's business experience and my experience along with this Ralph's in regulation to deal with a class of commodities which certainly do not exhaust the set of commodities in the world, but which have grown increasingly important for the economy, for industrial organization, and for international trade. These are the commodities in whose production there are large startup costs. That is, to begin producing such an item, you can't just start small. You really have to invest heavily, and associated with that, commodities that entail scale economies. Other people have recently written about that. I just saw James Mead yesterday, and he was one of the early contributors and profound contributors to that field. But up till now, the sort of work, the sort of arena I will be exploring has dealt with small models entailing two countries and two commodities. You will see, I hope, before this afternoon is over, why they did so, and why we, having found ways to go beyond that and deal with many commodities, have found that the inclusion of the many commodities of reality is what Marx might have described as a change from quantitative to qualitative. That is, that the entire picture with which one, the classical economists described the world changes profoundly. Not that they were wrong. What they said for those commodities about which they were talking continues to be right, but for the rest of the world, that is the world of scale economies, industries with heavy startup costs, we come to a very different picture. The Ricardian analysis, as you know, led to a very, very sanguine view of what the market forces would do in international trade. It told us that there were voluntary gains, that there were mutual gains from voluntary trade, that those who said that trade meant you gain only by beggaring your neighbor, as Adam Smith put it, was wrong. That in fact, if there was voluntary exchange, I traded with you only if I preferred what you gave me and you preferred what I gave you. Furthermore, the analysis told us that the market forces would inevitably, with some exceptions, I mean, I'm not suggesting that the classical or neoclassical economists were hopelessly naive. They recognized externalities, monopoly problems, etc. But taking those as exceptional matters would always lead by the solution that comported with the law of comparative advantage to most efficient production, to greatest prosperity and mutual gains. Now, there are two features about this that are worth noting. First, the first is that it means that in this model, the market gods are in effect deprived of all freedom. There is only one equilibrium. They may have set it up, but as the 18th century philosophers would have it, once God had wound up the great watch that was the universe, it ran by itself and needed no further intervention and would always drive us, keep the correct time, or in this case, drive us to the uniquely correct, that is, efficient solution. Now, in the world of startup costs and scale economies, things are very different. The market gods are released from their bondage. They have choices. There is not one equilibrium, but many. Not many, just many, but an astronomical number. If you represent each equilibrium by a dot in a graph, and I threaten to show you that tomorrow, the region becomes black with dots when you merely are trading 10 commodities, and when you are trading thousands, night has fallen totally over the region. Not only are there many choices for the market gods to make, but in fact, they make it what may seem to be capriciously, that is, by the happenstance of history. And this is important because it turns out that while there are indeed possible outcomes of the market, which are efficient, which are mutually beneficial, there are others that are extremely damaging to the interests of one or both trading countries. And once fallen into such a trap, there is an enormous force of local stabilization that makes it very difficult for the countries, either singly or in combination, to extract themselves. So what this says is, number one, that in this world I will be describing, not all the possible outcomes of the market forces provide mutual gains. In some cases, there are possible gains which country A can only gain at the expense of country B. There are some cases which are replaced by mutual losses, and some cases in which at least one of the countries ends up in an equilibrium that places it in a worse position than it would be in autarky, meaning that in a worse position than if it were completely to seal itself off from trade altogether. And as I will emphasize, these are not unrealistic possibilities, even though the path by which I will get there is abstract. The results are important because they are not abstractions, and they help us to get insights into practical issues like the ones that, for example, became very important in North America just a few months ago, when the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, was signed, an agreement among Canada, the United States, and Mexico, in which the unions were bitterly opposed to the signing of the treaty, and in which all living ex-presidents appeared on television simultaneously on the other side, and in which economic analysis was really able to offer very little insight. And I hope that this analysis will at least move us in the right direction. Let me, before I get into those abstractions with which I have been threatening you. Let me just give you a sample of some of the results which emerge so you can see where we are heading and what it is that all this construct is for. One of the implications is, for example, for development strategies. It says that the developing country's most effective strategy may be entry on a significant scale into a few industries where their position is retainable against incursions by others, rather than any attempt to emerge and to advance along a broad front. If you think about it, that almost immediately follows from the notion of scale economies and startup costs. It means that in such industries, you cannot hope to get in incrementally, bit by bit. You have to enter full-blown like Athena from Zeus's head. And that means that you must pick a few places in which to deploy your forces, as indeed has been done, the evidence shows, by the tiger economies of the Far East. Now, second, we will show that whereas in a world of scale diseconomies or constant returns to scale in a Ricardian world, if England happens to lose, say, the trade of automobile production or some other production to another country, the law of comparative advantage says that that must be because England lost comparative advantage in automobile production, therefore it must have gained comparative advantage in something else, production of cloth, to use the Ricardian example, or TV sets, or whatever, and will therefore automatically gain one industry for the other lost. In the world we will be describing, that does not happen, and one country therefore can acquire an industry from another without the other receiving a compensating offset. Now, when these are wealthy countries and one of them gains an industry from another, it will also have gained at the expense of the other. That is, the loss of automobile production from England to France makes France wealthier and England poorer. But when you get to trade between a developed and an underdeveloped country, if Brazil takes the hand calculator industry away from the United States, there is an opportunity for mutual gains. That is, not only may Brazil be better off, but the United States may be better off for a variety of reasons, not least of which is that a wealthier Brazil becomes a better customer. So this and rules like resuscitation of very limited form of infant industry protection, all sorts of things that are unfamiliar from the Ricardian model, suddenly return and become very practical possibilities in the real world, in which not all, but a substantial proportion of commodities have the attributes of startup costs and scale economies, not only a substantial proportion, but you will notice those of the industries that most concern policy, that most concern government, both in regulation, in monopolies analysis, and in trade, where we worry not so much about trade in small diminishing returns industries as in our preeminence or lack of it in the high-tech industries, the ones with the scale economies and the startup costs. So these are not only real, but they are generally, I think, deemed to be important. So all these matters arise under scale economies because in those circumstances, the market makes so many possible outcomes available, and the issue is to determine which of these outcomes are favorable to society and what are the means to achieve those favorable results. But first, we must see why startup costs and scale economies of the modern world make for the profusion of possible outcomes, the outcomes which economists call equilibria. Now, I hope not, in fact, I know not all of you in the audience are fellow dismal scientists, so I will try to explain what I mean by these terms. And by an equilibrium, I mean a possible outcome of the market forces, which looks a little bit like a five-year plan. It is the outcome which says how much beet sugar will be produced, how many cars will be produced, what models, how much of each commodity will be produced, how much will be produced in each country, how much will be imported, how much will be exported, what employment there will be, what the wage level will be, and what the prices will be. In other words, an equilibrium is like a page on a spreadsheet, horrid term, which specifies for each commodity how much will be produced and traded and at what price it will sell. And in the Ricardian world, it told us that given the state of demand and the state of technology in each country, there was only one possible outcome, the one which was made the most efficient use of the world's resources under the law of comparative advantage. Why in the classical world was there always an automatic tendency towards the most efficient outcome? The answer is very simple, because in the classical world, with diminishing returns, meaning bigger is more expensive, a firm or a country could enter on a very small scale, and being small, it was cheaper, and it could get a foothold. Meaning that if there was any outcome that involved inefficiency, then it was an invitation to a horde of tiny, more efficient entrants to come in with little risk because they were investing little effort, little capital, and little of anything else, and gradually move the economy in the right direction, driving out those who had committed the crime of inefficiency. But of course, high startup costs undermine that happy scenario. They say, thou canst not enter small. Thou must enter on a large scale so you can cover those startup costs, so you can take advantage of the fact that under scale economies, bigger is cheaper and smaller is prohibitively expensive. Not only, therefore, does the mechanism of small-scale entry disappear, and therefore all the sanguine confidence in the outcomes with it, but under scale economies, under the many equilibria in the extreme case, you have an extreme tendency towards specialization. The reason for that is also easy to say. If bigger is cheaper, then if England and France are both producing TV sets, and England suddenly gets ahead of France in the volume of its production, its costs will go down, the French costs will go up, and the market therefore will either gradually or rapidly shift to the English side. You'll notice I have the outcome come out the right way for
didn't.
So that in a world of scale economies, you have a movement toward specialization. That is, in reality, these items with scale economies and startup costs will be produced in only one or two or three countries, not 20 or 50, because when the 21st country tries to get in, it can only come in on a small scale, and that means it cannot come in at all. So you tend to get specialized equilibria. You can have non-specialized ones, but I will have trouble enough dealing only with the specialized ones. So let's concentrate only on those. And why are there so many of them? Well, think about it. Think of my example of France and Great Britain producing television sets. In my story, there was the happenstance that the British jumped ahead in the quantity they produced, and therefore the French share declined, and so French costs went up and British went down. But that was pure happenstance. Change the scenario a little bit. Have someone in Normandy or Aquitaine build a new plant and expand the French output, and it is the French costs that go down and the English that go up. In other words, either specialized outcome is possible, and once it happens, once France is producing all the television sets, it is extremely difficult for England to get back, or once England is producing all the television sets, it is very hard for the French to get back. Meaning what? Number one, as I said, there tends to be specialization. Which way that specialization turns out is a matter of happenstance. Whoever happens to become big becomes the most economical producer, and that can mean that France ends up producing all the television sets, England ends up producing all the wine. Ricardo, again, a likely story, but still. And so you end up with specialization, which, once you have gotten into it, can be changed. It's not impossible. It does happen, but it does not happen easily. Once you have acquired an industry, it becomes retainable in the sense that others cannot easily take it away from you because They cannot just put a toe into the water. They cannot embark into its production on a small scale. The next thing, the next step in all this is that, as I've said, there are specialized and a number of equilibria, but in fact, we can calculate how many specialized equilibria there will be. For example, let's just deal with a world in which there are two countries and these two commodities, wine and TV sets. What are the possible specialized outcomes? Number one, France may produce both of them and England neither. Or England may produce both of them and France neither. Or England may produce television sets and France wine, or heaven help us, it may go the other way. Meaning that with just two commodities, there are four possible outcomes. In fact, the number of outcomes increases much more than the number of commodities, roughly at what Malthus used to call a geometric rate of growth. That is, it increases exponentially. Those of you who way back took some mathematics, or those who know about it now, know that what I am talking about is the possible combinations of assignments of commodities among nations, so that the more commodities you have being traded, the more possible assignments, specialized assignments there are, and each of them is one of the outcomes that the market may produce. But notice, these outcomes may assign production of a good to the country which, by climatic conditions, training of the workforce, etc., is very well suited to its production, or it may not. Even if the country is a poor, quotes naturally, a poor producer of the commodity, it may be that sheer scale economies will make it the more competitive producer of that commodity once it has gotten, become the sole producer of the item. So that the more commodities there are, the more possible outcomes there are, and each of them is a possible resting place for the market forces. Not one of them is an outcome that the market gods cannot possibly select as an equilibrium point. Roughly speaking, with two countries, the number of possible five-year plans, the number of outcomes, the number of equilibria increases as 2 to the nth power. With two commodities, 4 outcomes, with 3 commodities, 9 outcomes. I've got it all wrong, but never mind. It increases geometrically as the number of commodities grows, so that with only a few thousand commodities, you literally get into the millions of possible outcomes. And as I have said, those possible outcomes are very different in the sorts of benefits they offer. They also will entail different prices, different apportionments of the labor force, different degrees of wealth of the individual economies, because once we have a choice of assignment of commodities among countries, that the laws of supply and demand will determine quantity sold, they will determine prices, and once you know how much will be sold, once you know at what price it will be sold, you know how much income each country will receive, and it will hardly surprise you that the share of the world's income that accrues to any one country will increase the larger the share of the world's commodities that fall into its zone of production. So we are left then with not one equilibrium, but with a vast number. We are left not with an equilibrium that is virtually ideal, but one whose virtues are questionable. And in addition, in reality, I've talked about specialized equilibria. You also have what we observe in the world of reality, equilibria not in which one country alone produces computers, but in which they are produced by 3, 4, 5 countries, but no sixth country can easily enter because you cannot enter on a small scale. So the norm we find in the world is what we may call quasi-specialized production, that is, production in which each country, which the world country, I'm sorry, I'll start over again, and a solution in which the world's countries form a tight oligopoly, so to speak, in which commodities typically are produced successfully by 3, 4, 6, or 8 countries, and from which all other countries are effectively excluded except by the most enormous effort and the most heroic measures. So this is where this is the problem, this is the picture that, as far as I know, has never been seen before in trade analysis, because in the conventional analysis, even with scale economies, we are used to ending up with pictures showing one equilibrium, or as those who have studied scale economies have shown, 3 equilibria, 4 equilibria, because they have dealt with 2 countries and 2 commodities, as I have shown. What happens is that in reality, we have not 4 equilibria, but this vast number that I have now roughly described to you. As I will show tomorrow, one might expect that these equilibria have a haphazard relationship to one another and form no discernible pattern, something that in the days before the term took on a special meaning we might have called chaotic. In fact, it is nothing of the sort. We will find tomorrow that when we represent these equilibria in a very simple manner, that they form a constantly repeated and very simple pattern. They fall into a well-defined region, which always, as you will see tomorrow, looks like a crescent moon, and which falls into that region for reasons that, after you have seen it, become easy to understand, though I can assure you it surprised Ralph and then afterwards me entirely when we first saw it experimentally. Not only does it form that uniform shape, which is a curiosum that might be considered fun by any perverse dismal scientist, but it turns out to have profound implications for policy. Indeed, many of those implications that I listed to you at the beginning of this talk. It will tell us about the acquisition of industries by one country from another, about how, in some circumstances, countries are indeed able, naturally put in an adversary relationship in their trade relations, so that my gains do indeed imply losses for you, while in other cases there really are opportunities for cooperation and mutual gains. So that tomorrow, having offered you chaos today, I will hope to restore order out of chaos and show you that this is not merely an amusing observation, but that this is both, I hope you will agree, good theory and a good way of leading us to better practice. Thank you very, very much.
Well, after that ebullient presentation, I don't think we can describe Professor Baumol as a dismal scientist. All very plausible. We'll wait to be convinced tomorrow. But clearly there are some lacunae in the existing approaches to these questions of economic union. I remember quite a long time ago now when the question arose whether Britain should join the common market. A distinguished and large group of economists with all the professional authority at their command published a letter in the Times explaining that their discipline assured them, and they wished to assure the public, that joining the common market was in the interest of the United Kingdom, which prompted another letter signed by an equally large number of equally distinguished economists some 2 days later asserting the contrary, which prompted me to write a letter all by myself, which was published 2 days later, which said that I didn't know and I wasn't ashamed to admit it. So I was right. Then we meet in 24 hours to have some of these assertions proved. Thank you, William.
Only one comment. These assertions will only be explained intuitively tomorrow. No formal proofs, but Ralph on Thursday.
That Ralph.
Yes, that Ralph, not this Ralph, will indeed take us one large step forward into actually proving
their
assertions.
All right, heuristics tomorrow.
Yes,